Before I begin, does anyone have any questions or points they want to bring up about the course? Yeah? Yes? No. The reason for that is I was just covering myself because I sometimes forget to turn on the Runecast thing, this little thing. Or sometimes, you know, another thing that happens is the batteries sometimes go dead. And they're supposed to be this little thing that tells you how strong the batteries are, but it's not always 100% accurate. So I've had these experiences with, I thought I was recording it, and then it turns out that, it starts making funny noises in the middle of the lecture and so on. And so it turns out it's not being recorded, or half of it is being recorded. But I'll make a special point of turning this thing on Friday, just to be absolutely certain that you don't have that problem. Anything else? Okay. Today I'm going to be talking about great power politics in the period immediately after the Treaty of Versailles was signed. In June 1919. This is a period from 1919 to 1923. Very important period in our story. What are we concerned with today? Well, what are we concerned with in this class as a whole? We're trying to get at this fundamental issue, how does international politics work? Meaning, preeminently, what makes for war, or conversely, what makes for a stable international system? And we're trying to get at that issue, not by approaching it at a very abstract level, but by looking at the historical record and seeing what that record tells us about that question. And in this particular case, we have this very striking fact that Germany is thoroughly defeated in 1918. The three Western democracies have been able to defeat Germany so thoroughly that they can impose their own peace terms on that country. They no longer have any need of an Eastern ally. Russia had been defeated in the war by Germany. In 1917, there was the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. The Bolsheviks took took Russia out of the war and accepted a peace with Germany, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in early 1918, that basically gave the Germans everything they wanted in the East. Germany was able to face the Western powers unencumbered by the need to conduct a war in the East in 1918. Brest-Litovsk, Brest-Litovsk. It's a little town that was then on the kind of the border between Russia and Poland. Okay, you have to know stuff like that. I promise you, I'm not going to ask you about the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk on any of the exams. The exams will be more basic things than that. Okay, so the Western powers impose this peace, but that peace turns out to be extremely unstable. And just 20 years later, you have this new and far more dangerous war with Germany breaking out. How do you explain this? How do you understand it? And the answer you give to that kind of question will give you insight into these general issues about how international politics works in general. Because there's a traditional view that explains the Second World War. It's like, you want to understand the Second World War? It's very simple. A one-word answer to the question of what caused the Second World War. That word begins with H, right? It's Hitler. Hitler did it. Hitler's responsible. Yeah, you know, that's end of story. Just like the way people explain the war in the Pacific, the U.S.-Japanese war that broke out in December 1941. Very simple, two-word answer in this case, Pearl Harbor. End of story. Don't have to look beyond. One of the main insights that's emerged as people have grappled with this problem in a serious way, historians have grappled with it, is that those kind of interpretations, explanations, they're much too simple. They really don't capture the heart of what was going on. How many of you in the culture, you want to understand the Second World War? You have to understand it in moral terms. Hitler was evil. Hitler was aggressive. You know, and the Japanese too, they were very aggressive too. You know, whereas the Western democracies are these peace-loving countries that ask, you know, basically to be left alone. War is understood preeminently in moral terms. Very sharp distinction in the literature between the 1920s and the 1930s. Traditional. You know, other factors, well, it wasn't just Hitler, but Hitler was made possible by, well, two big things. One was the Depression, and the other was the Treaty of Versailles. You know, the Great Depression of the 1930s, that was a big source of international instability, because in the 1920s, things were much nicer, much sunnier. You know, it really seemed like after a bit of trouble in the first half of the decade, Germany and the Western countries had managed to bury the hatchet. Germany was being run by, you know, good Europeans, people who wanted Germany to get along with her Western neighbors. And it seemed in the late 1920s that something of that sort was taking shape. And if it hadn't been for the Depression, everything would have been okay. Right. How important were economic factors in the story? Well, you can get at that by looking at whether there were serious problems, the sorts of problems that could conceivably ultimately lead to war prior to the outbreak of the Great Depression. You know, were things all that rosy in the 1920s? Is that interpretation would have you believe? You can see what German policy really was during this period. Whether there was a big structural problem that had been unresolved that lay at the heart of the system. People say, well, look how harshly Germany was treated in the Treaty of Versailles. This explains a lot about why Hitler came to power. The Allies made this big mistake in treating Germany like a criminal country. You know, again, it's a moral thing. This is just a moral error. Think about it. Compare the Versailles settlement, the settlement after World War I, with the sort of settlement that was in effect imposed on Germany after World War II. In Versailles, Germany was left intact. At Versailles, Germany was allowed to retain her sovereignty as a nation. After World War II, that's not the case. Germany is divided in half. Half of pre-war German territory is basically ruled by foreign power, the Soviet Union. Partly directly, and partly through satellite states like East Germany and Poland. Even West Germany was not a fully sovereign country after World War II. If the touchstone of sovereignty is your ability to defend yourself, the ability to decide for yourself what sort of military forces you want to build, and Germany still is not a fully sovereign country because Germany is obliged by the treaty providing the framework for the reunification of Germany, the Treaty of Moscow, 1991, to not build nuclear weapons, to not have a nuclear capability. And there's no way in the nuclear age in which a great power could defend itself against the other great powers that do have nuclear weapons if it does not have a nuclear capability. What this means is that Germany, as long as she was a non-nuclear power, West Germany during the Cold War, was utterly dependent on her allies and had to kind of toe their line politically to a very significant extent. This was a very different sort of settlement in terms of what it did to Germany, what it did to German power, than the 1919 settlement. And yet we all think of the 1945 arrangement as basically quite stable. You know, it locked Germany, West Germany, into dependence on the Western powers for protection because the Soviet Union was right there on their border. And they were too weak to stand up to the Soviets by themselves. And as long as they were dependent on the Western powers for protection, they had to basically accept Western policy, which was content to live with the status quo. So the Germans were more or less forced to live with the division of their country and the fact that half of their country was under communist rule. What had been their country was under communist rule. Okay? 1919, different story. And yet, there was far more resistance in 1919 than after 1919 than after 1945. It's not the harshness of the treaty itself that explains why you had this resistance. There are more factors that come into play. And what are those factors? They have to do with power. Why could Germany not accept the Versailles system, whereas they in effect had no choice but to accept the 1945 system? Well, it was because after 1945, it would have been suicidal to resist it. You know, you risk a war in which the Soviets would be provoked. You would be lucky to be overrun in that kind of war. More likely, you would be utterly destroyed. You put the one guarantee of your security, the alliance with the Western powers, at risk by pursuing a provocative policy. You're not going to do that. The power political conjuncture is the key thing that explains the difference. Because after 1919, the situation was totally different. It's going to be the main point of the lecture today, what that situation was. You know, resistance would not have, you know, was not suicidal. In fact, it was successful. The Germans had every incentive to resist. And once you start thinking in those terms, what you see is that international politics, even the whole story of the origins of the Second World War, the failure of the Versailles Peace and the coming of the Second World War, is not to be understood in essentially moral terms. It's to be understood in political terms, in terms that have a lot to do with power realities, not just with good and evil or right and wrong or all that kind of thing. The point that the line between the 1920s and the 1930s is not nearly as sharp as people think. There's a continuity because the basic political problem remains intact, and that political problem doesn't have to do with one side being good and the other side being bad, because, you know, as an impartial analyst, you could step outside and look at the situation through the eyes of all the major powers that were involved. And you can kind of sympathize with these different perspectives. It's not that it was evil or wrong of the Germans to resist the treaty. On the other hand, it wasn't evil or wrong of the French to want to enforce it. Right? Both countries were behaving with an eye to their security interests, to their power political interests. The whole issue should be understood in political and not in moral terms. And that's going to be a very important theme for us in this course. It's like one of the basic things that you want to take away from the study of international politics. Okay? All right, so let me talk about what the structure of great power politics was, what the structure of power was in the European political system in this period, and why the Germans felt, you know, that a policy of resistance was viable. Why a lot of Germans felt that this was the way to go. Not all of them by any means, and I'll talk about that later. But why the Germans felt that they could resist the Versailles system. Don't forget the essence of the Versailles system. It's a set of constraints on German power. Germany is not treated as an equal. Germany does not have the same rights as the victor powers. above all in the military sphere. Germany is not allowed to build up her power to whatever level she wants. The size of her armed forces is limited, just 100,000 men in the German army, no air force, no navy to speak of. Right? Rhineland is supposed to be demilitarized. In other words, Germany is supposed to be vulnerable to invasion from France. No fortresses there. The Allies, for a certain period, are allowed to occupy the Rhineland. And thus, you know, the knife is even closer to Germany's throat, especially to Germany's industrial heartland, which is called the Ruhr Basin, the Ruhr being a little river that's a tributary of the Rhine, right in western Germany there, just basically a stone's throw from the area that the Allies are occupying. That's the great center of Germany's heavy industry, coal mining, steel production, the finishing industries that grow around the steel mills and so on. And that's the heart of the industrial economies of this period, and also the heart of their war-making capability. Steel production is extremely important then, much more so than it had been century earlier, much more so than it is today. It was in the militarized zone, but initially it wasn't occupied, but it was just a stone's throw away from the French army on the Rhine, so the French could threaten to occupy the Ruhr and to paralyze Germany's economic life. And as you see over here, they actually move into the Ruhr in January of 1923. Okay. The situation that the structure of the political system that was established by the Treaty of Versailles. So Germany's the essence of it. The essence of Versailles is that it's a set of constraints on German power. Germany is kept down. Germany is not allowed to build up her power to the same extent as the victor countries. From the French point of view, this was not the optimal system. This was not their ideal political system that they hope to see emerge from the Yes, Germany should be kept down, but in the French conception, that was not to be fundamental. Why? Because these are artificial constraints, legal constraints. What are you going to do if Germany resists? Can you have a viable political system with a knife to their throat forever? Wouldn't you want something that's more natural, less artificial? And a natural system is a great mass of power on Germany's western border, so great that Germany couldn't conceive of challenging the predominance of the western powers. And that meant France's two big wartime allies, the United States and Great Britain, would remain associated with France in the post-war periods, associated militarily, that they would have troops in northern France, in the Rhineland, that they would coordinate their policy in this regard. And we saw that that wasn't going to be. The Americans pull out very quickly. A lot of people think, oh, well, this is because Wilson was defeated. Wilson was not an isolationist. He was an internationalist. Wilson was a great believer in the League of Nations. But he came back to his own country, and he was repudiated by these Republican senators who prevented the Treaty of Versailles from being ratified by the Senate. You need a two-thirds vote. Wilson didn't quite have it. And because the Treaty of Versailles went down, the League of Nations covenant was also defeated. So the United States didn't join the League. And it's because Wilson couldn't get the Senate to ratify the League of Nations Covenant that the United States switched from this enlightened Wilsonian policy of internationalism to this retrograde Republican policy of isolationism. I mean, that's the kind of interpretation that you get from the larger culture. It's the sort of thing that's taught in high school. If, you know, the problem was that the League of Nations was defeated, that the Senate refused to ratify it. And you have to ask yourself, well, what difference would it have made if the United States had joined the League? We would have pursued the same policy inside the League as we had pursued outside the League. And that saying that policy was to not commit our troops to the preservation of the existing balance of power, to keeping Germany down indefinitely. Wilson disliked the idea of the use of force in peacetime. He disliked what he viewed as international militarism. Militarism was bad on a domestic level. It was also bad on an international level. We had done our job. We had kind of slayed the dragon, and now we're going to go home and tend to our own affairs. And yes, we'll still be involved in the world, but we'll do it by taking advantage of our high moral status. I mean, I don't know if you saw the president's State of the Union address last night. He's using this term, the indispensable nation. We are the indispensable nation. You know, it comes from a political scientist named Joseph Nye, wrote a book with that title. That's the way a lot of Americans think about the United States. We're better than the rest of the world. Look at how wonderful our own internal political institutions are. We're this just wonderful country, and so we will preach to the rest of the world, and we will tell them what to do, and that's how we'll be involved in the world, because everyone knows we're morally superior. I mean, this is a strand in U.S. thinking about foreign policy that just runs through a lot of the history of the 20th century. It's not the only strand, and American leaders are often capable of thinking in much more realistic terms. But Wilson's didn't view American power as a normal, natural, integral part of the European political system. He didn't think in terms of what it would take to create a stable structure of power. Well, for Wilson, you saw this in those wartime speeches, the whole notion of the balance of power was anathema. You don't want to conduct a policy based on those principles. The problem was that these European countries insisted on thinking in these reactionary balance of power terms. That's what had caused the First World War to begin with. That's going to be a problem in the post-war period. So Wilson, Americans in general, are averse to continued involvement in a serious way in European history. Withdraw their forces from France as soon as they can, well before Wilson leaves office, or well before he's forced to by the Congress, because Wilson policy is not forward-looking in the sense of concern with how to create a stable international order in Europe. And don't forget, there's a very important difference in U.S. economic policy after World War I as compared with after World War II. After World War II, Americans are quite generous. They understand the importance of helping these European countries that recover economically from the war. The Marshall Plan is one of the great accomplishments of the United States in the 20th century. You don't have anything like that after World War I. The French wanted that sort of arrangement to come into being. Their whole notion was, if we're serious about the war, you know, it was a common effort. And the burdens of a common effort, we had common goals. The burdens of the war should be shared equally by everybody. We shouldn't have to bear the whole brunt of it. You know, and they had this notion of equality and community of sacrifice. If we're all in this together in the war, we should share the burdens of the peace, in the economic sphere as well as in the political sphere. But Wilson was not having any of it. You know, it's like, he says, we should give with a stinted hand, he says. You know, even before the Versailles Treaty was signed. You know, as soon as the armistice was signed, you know, that was it in terms of the aid to Europe. We threw the harness off, Wilson said, meaning that the wartime controls were dismantled practically overnight. Okay. Well, think of the situation that this put the French in. In a sense, from their point of view, thinking in geopolitical terms, this is not totally unexpected. Big difference between American policy and French policy is not that one is a democracy and the other isn't. In some respects, France in those days was more democratic than the United States was. The big difference has to do with where they're situated in geopolitical terms, what their geopolitical position is. You have to remember, the United States is by far the strongest country in the world already in terms of its mobilizable war potential, you know, as measured most notably by steel production. And as though that weren't enough, you don't have any security threats. You have these weak neighbors in the north and the south, and then these huge oceans to the east and the west. And who's going to attack the United States? And so a country that is so secure can afford to indulge itself in the luxury of geopolitical thinking. But France doesn't have that luxury. France, a country of 40 million, is faced right next door with Germany, a country of 60 million. Right? France can't move away from the continent of Europe. France is basically stuck there. And what that means is that they have to be concerned with power political realities. They have to be concerned about their own security, with a possible German threat, with the structure of power in Europe, and so on. So what's their situation in 1919? They feel abandoned. They feel like the sort of political structure they would have wanted to see come into being was just not there. And instead of a continuing presence of Britain and the United States on the European continent, they withdraw. France is basically left to fend for herself. In the long run, maybe France needs decent relations with Britain and America, because if the Germans break out again, France needs somebody to come to their aid. They can't hold the line against the Germans by themselves. Germany is inherently a much stronger country than France. But in the short run, they are more inclined to maintain the Versailles system than they otherwise might. They can't simply dismantle all of these constraints on German power, because if they did, German resources were such that Germany would re-emerge as the strongest power in Europe, because German resources are so much greater than those of any of the other countries on the continent. And in fact, Germany would be in a stronger position relative to the other countries of Europe, if that were to happen, than she had been in 1914. Why? Just remember, 1914, Germany is faced with a coalition of the three next most important powers in Europe. Right? In particular, the two next most important continental powers, France and Russia. But after 1919, she doesn't have anything to worry about on her eastern border. Right? It's not just that Russia is in turmoil as a result of the revolution and the civil war that it triggered. On the ruins of the Russian Empire were erected a whole string of states, not just of the Russian Empire, but also of the Austrian Empire, a whole string of states in the borderland between Germany and Russia. You know, just look at the map. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, you know, Czechoslovakia, you know, Hungary, Romania, Yugoslavia. It's like states that were tied to the West in important ways. The West was the patron of these new fledgling states in Eastern Europe. The patron because, well, for one thing, the West basically believed in the principle of self-determination. Wilson himself was the great champion of Poland, of the resurrection of Poland. It was one of the 14 points. And Poland is the most important of these new states. Important not just because of its size, but because of its geographical position, right astride the main invasion routes between Germany and Russia. But a Poland with ties to the West freed Germany of any concern about a future Russian threat. A big difference from 1914. Why did it free Germany from that concern? Simply because Poland existed and the Soviets are such great believers in respecting the rights of other countries that they would never have invaded Polish territory? No, it was because Poland had ties to the West. As a matter of fact, Poland had a formal military alliance with France in the interwar period. This, as you may recall, was the issue that led to the outbreak of the Second World War in 1939. Poland's ties with the West. But what that meant was that Germany was shielded from any possible future Soviet threat by the existence of this Poland tied to the West, because it served as a kind of tripwire. If the Soviets were ever to move west through Poland, the Western powers would come to their aid. So the Germans didn't have to worry about Soviet pressure. And conversely, it worked the other way in shielding the Soviets from any possible German threat. If the Germans moved east, which is the story of what happened in 1939, the Soviets could count on the fact that the Western powers would intervene in the war. The possibility of Western intervention would deter a German move. So the 1919 system in that regard was more favorable in terms of its basic structure than the 1914 system had been. The resurrection of Poland was an asset for Germany. It was ultimately it was an ingredient contributing to German power, to a relatively strong power political position for Germany. So the French couldn't just dismantle the Versailles constraints and see Germany walk away from her treaty commitments with impunity. Because that would mean the German power would once again dominate Europe, more so than in 1914. And given that there was no effective counterweight to Germany in the West, because America had withdrawn and Britain had kind of half withdrawn, the French really had to worry about how to deal with Germany, and that meant that they were more inclined than they otherwise might have been to insist that the Versailles system be maintained. And that meant, if the Germans resisted, the Versailles system had to be enforced, because if it wasn't enforced, it would collapse. Right? So the French, because, you know, if you allow Germany to reemerge as the number one power in Europe, which she would if you simply dismantled the Treaty of Versailles, what was the point of fighting the war? France had made this huge effort, huge blood price paid from 1914 to 1918. And now the result of the Allied victory would be to see Germany even stronger than she had been in 1914? No, you couldn't just walk away from Versailles. This didn't mean that this was the only consideration shaping French policy. The need to maintain fairly decent relations, the approval of the Anglo-Saxons, well, that was another factor affecting French policy. And if the Anglo-Saxons were pulling back from the notion of enforcement of the treaty, well, the French had to kind of take that into account. And then there was another way of dealing with this problem is, yeah, you didn't want to dismantle the Versailles constraints overnight, But maybe you could reach some sort of accommodation with the Germans. Maybe you could relate to them on a more equal basis. Maybe together you could build a viable Western European community. And the Bolshevik Revolution was a big factor here too in this kind of thing. Who would profit if France and Germany were each other's throats? Only the communists. If you were concerned about the communist threat, then you really kind of had to do what you could to bury the hatchet between France and Germany. So there was an interest in testing the waters on the part of the French to see if some sort of accommodation with the Germans could be reached. We saw this in 1919 in the middle of the peace conference itself. 1920, very important strand of French policy. And it's very clear when you look at the documents that sort of policy was rooted in their disillusionment with Britain and America. The fact that they had been abandoned, practically betrayed by their Anglo-Saxon allies. This was an argument for mending fences with the Germans, because bad relations between France and Germany, the only ones to profit from that in the West would be Britain and America, not France and Germany. You never profit from bad relations. So there are these attempts on the part of the French. It's like you could understand French policy, right? But does that mean that the Germans were wrong to resist the treaty? You could also understand why the Germans wanted to resist. Yeah? A lot of it has to do with being kept down means that they're incapable of defending themselves. Every other country is allowed to build up whatever military force it wants, even the Soviet Union, not Germany. Germany in this post-war Europe can't defend itself. A great nation like Germany has to be vulnerable to intervention and thus to political influence on the part of other powers. Countries want to control their own destiny. That means that they need to be able to defend themselves. So there's this kind of hard power political reality there, but there are also a set of moral considerations. The rationale for keeping Germany down, the rationale for the Versailles system, the set of constraints on German power, unequal treatment of Germany, was that Germany had caused the war. Because if Germany had not caused the war, what justification was there for treating Germany in that way? This is very explicit at the Paris Peace Conference. You know, it's not that Wilson objected to that way of looking at things. That was his way of looking at things. The Germans had caused the war. They should be subjected to a generation of thoughtfulness. During that period, they would not have the same rights as the victor powers. Hopefully, what they would do is they would work their way back into the community of civilized nations by making penance for their crimes, for admitting that they were wrong and doing what they had to do to become good Europeans. By the way, not totally absurd, because that was what the Germans did after World War II. Okay. The Germans have an interest in resisting, but that's not the whole story. The question is, when they're deciding on what policy to pursue, the question is whether a policy of resisting the treaty was viable. You're not going to do it if it's suicidal. They don't like the division of their country after World War II, but they don't resist because resistance would have been suicidal. After World War I, basically, they wet their finger and put it up to the winds, and they look at power political realities around them, and the realities are, we could get away with this. Yeah, or a good chance that we could. We may have trouble, but we could surmount those problems. Okay? Why? Because France is a weak country, led white by the war. There's no threat to us on the east. Plus, the Anglo-Saxons are increasingly sympathetic with us and against the use of force to constrain us, to keep us down. Because British and American policy had changed very dramatically from 1919 to 1920. In large part because they were surprised that Germany was resisting. and this forced them to kind of reconsider their basic approach to peacemaking. So look, the Germany would just accept the verdict. Germans aren't accepting it. Well, does this mean the treaty is actually going to have to be enforced? Well, you don't like the idea of the use of force. You start messing around with the use of force. That keeps everything stirred up. That keeps everything in turmoil. Maybe there should be a different approach. Maybe this whole idea of enforcement is not the way to go. Maybe we should rethink our policy and move away from these punitive notions that had dominated the peace conference period and move toward a policy of reconciliation with Germany, accommodation with Germany, trying to reach kind of practical understandings with Germany. Okay, so and then there are domestic political factors in both Britain and America that push things in this direction. One of the most important ones is the Depression of 1920 and 1921. Very sharp depression, a rival in intensity, although not in duration, the Great Depression of the 1930s. It was caused by the fact that during the war, everyone had financed the war through inflating their currencies. And now the notion was, now that we're back to peace, we need sound money again. And so they slam on the monetary brakes and they pursued deflationary policies. And the deflationary policies, you know, the drying up of demand and so on, these high interest rates, all that kind of thing, led to a very sharp slowdown in the level of economic activity. So they're not going to blame themselves, right? British and American governments aren't going to say, well, you know, this is natural. We had wartime inflation, post-war deflation. Unemployment is the consequence of a deflationary policy. No, they don't blame themselves. The problem is that we don't have peace. The problem is that things are all stirred up because the French have this notion that the treaty should be enforced. So we should make it pretty clear to the French that they should pursue a different policy. And that they shouldn't put the knife to Germany's throat in trying to enforce the treaty. Okay? So the Germans, they see all these things, say, well, if we resist, we're going to get important people on our side. In Britain, especially the famous economist John Maynard Keynes, end of 1919, writes this book called The Economic Consequences of the Peace, attack on the reparation provisions, especially of the peace treaty. This is going to keep Europe from recovering economically. This is just all terrible stuff. You know, makes a sensation. People, practically from the start, the Versailles settlement is discredited. Germans see this. It's an important element in their assessment of the situation. Resistance makes sense. You know, important forces are on our side. They're not going to attack us. And where does resistance focus? Let me just backtrack a bit. It's not that every German takes this view. There are Germans who take the view that a policy of resistance is not the way to go, that what we should do is try and reach an accommodation with the French, try and show our good faith, you know, try and reconstruct a European community. It's a significant element within the German policymaking elite, but not the dominant element. Dominant element takes a much harsher view, and it's quite clear that it's the overall geopolitical conjuncture that's the key factor in enabling them, encouraging them to pursue that sort of policy. Right? So what happens? German resistance intensifies as they see which way the wind is blowing. And what does it focus on? It focuses on one issue. The target is the Versailles system as a whole, the set of constraints on German power as a whole. They want to throw off what they call the shackles of Versailles, but they can't resist every aspect of the Versailles system all at once in a totally undifferentiated basis. Their resistance focuses on one issue. What is that issue? It's the reparation provisions in the Treaty of Versailles. Why do they focus on that? Because The reparation provisions are, in technical terms, the most difficult to enforce. In reparations, it's easiest for the Germans to get people to believe them when they say, what the Allies are asking for is beyond our capacity to pay. We just can't do it. They can't do that when it comes to dismantling fortresses. Obviously, they have the ability to do that. Or to withdraw their forces from the Rhineland. Obviously, they have the ability to do that. But with the reparations, it's a different story. They say, Germany was untouched by the war, but her finances are in shambles. Big debate within Germany about whether to allow the inflation to continue or to try and stabilize the currency. And there are major domestic economic arguments on both sides. But the what tips the balance in favor of the continuation of the inflationary policy is that the Germans realize that the continuation of the inflation allows them to tell their creditors in the West, we can't pay. Look at our domestic monetary problems. We can't even balance our own budget, and this is what's causing this inflation. And this inflation is, you know, as long as the inflation continues, we can't pay. And a lot of people in the West buy this sort of thing. Okay. So they focus on the reparations, which are the Achilles heel of the treaty, the weakest point in the treaty, the one which is morally most problematic, economically most questionable, it's technically most difficult to enforce. How do the French react to it? Do you find the French as saying, we insist on the strict enforcement of the treaty. The Germans have to comply with the treaty, you know, in every particular. And if they don't, we're going to invade. If they don't, we're going to ruin the German economy. No, you don't find the French thinking that line at all. You find the French, in fact, trying to work out an arrangement with the Germans on a business-like basis. This is especially true after the true under Clemenceau and negotiations that were conducted in the late 1919, but Clemenceau basically is forced from power and is replaced by a new French government under Alexandre Mirand in 1920. And the Mirand policy was a policy, they were quite open about this, and they used this term in public at the time, a policy of economic collaboration with Germany. They sent as their ambassador to Germany a man who they thought could oversee this. It was a great French industrialist named Charles Leroy. And it was clear that the French were hoping to reach some sort of arrangement with the Germans. They don't enforce or even try to insist on Germany complying with the key provisions in the Treaty of Versailles governing the reparations at this period. Instead, they say, let's put all of that at the back burner and let's try and work these things out. Where do you see this, for example? Coal. Coal, for example, this is one of the big things. In Western Europe, the heart of the Western European economy is this big complex from Lorraine going through the Ruhr, which produces both coal and iron ore, and those are the two big ingredients you need to produce steel, a certain type of coal called coking coal. It's all in that area. And so there's a natural complementarity between Germany and France in this area of heavy industry, because Germany has the right kind of coal, coking coal, and France has the iron ore. It's called minette iron ore, the French language. And to produce the steel, you need both of these things. So it makes sense to kind of pull these things together. France needs the German coal to keep those steel mills in Lorraine. And France feels that she has a right to this German coal. And what are they asking for? Asking Germany to give France everything that France wants? No, their whole line is that the two countries should have their needs for coal met to the same degree. Needs defined as the consumption in 1913 of areas that are within the 1919 borders. They want equal rates of satisfaction on those needs, not asking for more than what the Germans are giving themselves. And the Germans refuse to do this. They refuse to transfer the coal to that extent. This is not a question of their inability to pay. It's a question of their unwillingness to pay. Let me break the story right there, because to kind of continue it, I'll go into the next lecture. But the key thing to take away is that the French policy is not harsh. They're reaching for an accommodation with Germany, and it's not going to be achieved.